Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 4th of February. David Beckman is our guest this hour, president of Bread for the World. He is in town for the Interfaith Conference 40th Anniversary Luncheon taking place today. David has been president for 15 years. The mission is to lead large-scale and successful campaigning to strengthen U.S. political commitment to overcoming hunger and poverty. He also served at the World Bank for 15 years, overseeing large projects to make the bank more effective in reducing poverty. Bread for the World, one of the largest organizations in the world dedicated to building the political will to end hunger. You'll remember the Jubilee Movement, and Bread for the World led the U.S. legislative coalition to reduce the debts of low-income countries, has helped to double U.S. funding for poverty-focused development assistance, and win increases in nutrition assistance for food-insecure people in this country. David is also president of Bread for the World Institute. They do research and education on hunger-related issues, and he founded and serves as president of the Alliance to End Hunger. He is a clergyman as well as an economist and is the author of many books and articles. He's lived all over the world, in Bangladesh, in Ghana. He was recently in Mozambique and has visited more than 70 countries. Hello, David. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
There is, of course, a great deal of attention and a great deal of goodwill directed toward Haiti. It's been in the news ever since the earthquake, and we become aware of issues like hunger in the world and devastation when something huge like this happens. Two questions. One is, there are also people who are dying of hunger and diseases all over the world at a very large level in developing countries all the time. And number two is, how do you assess the aid effort that's been going toward Haiti right now?
Well, the first question is right on. We have a Haiti every week in poor countries in terms of the number of people dying. 25,000 children die needlessly every day, and most of them...
25,000.
It is stunning.
Yeah.
Most of them die in far-off, remote places or in slums. So it's not photogenic, and we don't, you know, we don't see the misery, but the misery, the death, the suffering is just as real. So, and in many of those places where people are dying routinely of poverty, it's in fact easier to make progress. 30 years ago, 50,000 kids died every day needlessly. So we can make progress in much of the world, and some of the most dramatic and most difficult situations, most concentrated poverty, that's what gets on TV, that's what grabs our hearts. Now, that it's right to grab our hearts. My sense is that the relief effort in Haiti is going as, I mean, very difficult circumstances, very difficult situation. There are no good solutions, but my sense is that it's being carried out well. I was really encouraged that President Obama put the U.S. Agency for International Development in charge. We could have had a general in charge, which would have been the wrong decision, because it's not just about maintaining security or passing out food for a couple months. It's also about setting in motion already from the first day processes by which Haitians can eventually get back up on their feet and make their country better than it's been for a long time. This is a country that has suffered from centuries of external manipulation and then internal corruption. So it is not going to be easy, but my sense is that we're off to a pretty good start. And I really appreciate the leadership of the U.S. Agency for International Development on this. Bread for the World's been campaigning just to get the director of the Agency for International Development appointed. There's been a long delay. And so I take some satisfaction from the fact that he sat down in his chair 5 days before the quake struck. And I think providentially so, because our response as a nation has been better for his leadership.
Yes. When you talked about there used to be 50,000 children dying every day, but we've made some progress, how have we made that progress?
Well, mostly it's poor people themselves and people in poor countries who've worked really hard to make their lives better. Assistance from the U.S. and other relatively wealthy countries has also helped, particularly on the child mortality. That's a question, an issue on which aid from the United States especially made a big difference. In the early 80s, it was right in the middle of another recession, and UNICEF had the idea that a lot of progress could be made without much money by just helping poor parents around the world know some simple things that they could do to keep their kids from dying. Like, you can put sugar and salt in the right proportions in clean water and give that to a child to keep the child from dehydrating from diarrhea. And a lot of kids in poor countries have diarrhea all the time. So now, you know, that was a UNICEF idea. But in fact, Bread for the World members across the country and other church groups campaigned around it. The U.S. government supported the idea in a big way. Because of those child survival programs that got started in the 80s, poor parents now all over the world know some things about how to keep their kids from dying, even if they're poor. Mm-hmm. It's a permanent change for the better in the world. And it's one, I guess I'm heartened that broadly hundreds of millions of people in the world have been escaping from hunger, poverty, and disease over the last generation. You know, we see Haiti or we see other terrible things and we think, oh my God, there's nothing we can do. But in fact, I'm a preacher, so I think this is God moving in our time, helping hundreds of millions of people escape from misery. And I think we have a chance to be part of it. What a great opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about the success of the Jubilee movement? And I'm interested in the area of debt relief for Haiti. Is Haiti in debt to a lot of countries in the world? And is debt relief a part of a movement now to help Haiti? And also the success of the Jubilee movement. It was quite successful, wasn't it?
It was a really wonderful religious and political movement. It was really led starting with the churches and other religious communities, and then by the time the campaign was over, we had a lot of people helping us. But it started out as a religious idea. Archbishop Tutu and Pope John Paul both suggested back in 1998 or so that with the year 2000, that could be a time to write off some of the unpayable debt of some of the world's poorest countries. We achieved that. Reduce the debt, not of all poor countries, but of poor countries who would use the money well. Part of the deal was that if the international community would reduce some of their unpayable debt, they would invest more in basic health and education. My sense is it's gone really well. So the most stunning, my favorite statistic in the world is that there are 30 million more African kids in school today than were in school in the year 2000. Let me repeat it. 30 million more African kids are in school today than were in school in 2000. And that started with the reduction of Africa's debt, or the debt of some of the African countries, and then has been sustained in part by increasing development assistance. Really a great success story. Part of the response to Haiti is going to need to be some reduction of its now absolutely unpayable debt. This is a small country, so we can do a lot of good with relatively small amounts of money. I mean, if people are worried, we need money here in Milwaukee, you know, that's true. But this is a very small country, very close to us, in a devastated circumstance. So we really do need to make a sustained commitment of it's not just passing out food for a few months. It's a sustained commitment to help them reconstruct their country. And part of that is going to be writing off some of their debts. I think also in the area of trade, we can do some things. In 2008, we allowed Haiti to export some more of their textiles into the U.S. market. And by reducing our protectionism in textiles a little bit, Haiti's textile industry boomed. Two-thirds of their exports are T-shirts and other textiles. But they could produce rice, they can produce sugar, and their production is stymied by our protectionism. Mm-hmm. So it's not just aid. It's debt relief, trade policy, also immigration policy. I think there are a lot of Haitians who have family in the U.S., and we should let those families help their family members out. And that's not easy to do, but we need that kind of integrated and consistent response over the coming couple decades to help these neighbors get back on their feet.
Let's go to the United States for a moment. The unemployment rate, 10% higher than that in some major cities in this country. That's a huge number of people who don't have work. So many people are underemployed. How do we tackle, and that results, of course, as you know, in people not being able to eat very much, have their medical needs met. As the president released his budget on Monday of this week, are there parts of this budget that deal with significantly with unemployment in this country, with food issues and hunger issues in the United States?
Actually, I think the budget's remarkably good. I was a little bit concerned in the State of the Union message that the president only mentioned poor people in the U.S. once. It was a lot of talk about the middle class, but poor people are also suffering. So I was a little worried that maybe in the changed political context that he was backing away from poor people. But the budget is remarkably good. Most importantly, I think it is a budget for economic recovery. And as Bread for the World thinks about economic recovery, we are convinced that for the recovery to be durable and sustainable, it also needs to be just and environmentally sensitive. Now a large part of our nation's population remains in a financial crisis. People say the financial crisis is over. If you don't have a job and you've got medical expenses, the crisis is not over. With a large part of the population in financial crisis, you can't have a robust recovery. So we need to deal – the recovery needs to include middle-income, low-income people for it to be robust. And I think the president's also right that global warming is real. We're going to have to deal with that. If we don't deal with it, the recovery will be short-lived. We'll run into a wall. And in fact, we can, as we make our economy a greener economy, we can do that in a way that creates new jobs. So getting the recovery, a just and sustainable recovery, is of central importance. And I think the president's budget focuses on just about the right things mm-hmm. in that regard. There are also, I mean, you can't wait for the recovery. The government collects statistics on hunger and food insecurity every year. And so we know that almost one in four U.S. children lives in a household that sometimes runs out of food. This number is way up because of the recession. One in four of our children is living in a household that is struggling to put food on the table. So we do have an opportunity this year to the president's asking to fill some holes in the nutrition programs for children. I think it's especially urgent that Congress move on that so that we can set up strong summer feeding programs this summer. When kids are not in school, they don't get their school lunch or school breakfast. So all the food banks in the country have a huge spike in need in the summertime. But we could this summer do a better job of setting up new mechanisms to get food to kids this summer. You know, if especially little kids even suffer moderate undernutrition, if their moms have to skimp and toward the end of the month really reduce their portions or maybe not let them eat certain meals, if that happens to little kids, that does real damage to their intellectual and personal development. God made kids to be – little kids are meant to be learning machines. You know, a two-year-old is meant to be learning all the time. And if they're not getting enough food or good food, their brains of little kids shut down a little bit. They don't learn. And so sustained modern undernutrition will do permanent damage to this whole generation. So we can't wait for the recovery to take care of hungry kids.
We welcome phone calls for David, and here's how you reach us. David Beckman is our guest this hour. He is president of Bread for the World. He's in Milwaukee today for the Interfaith Conference 40th Anniversary Luncheon. And we're talking about a number of issues, how we have made some progress, which is encouraging when it comes to battling hunger throughout the world. We're looking at what's been going on in Haiti. We're looking at the number of children who are dying every day because of lack of food all over the world, and that's a huge number. Debt relief, certainly. They were very instrumental in working with the Jubilee Movement. You may recall that a few years ago that asked for debt relief from developing countries in the world. We're looking at we have yet to talk more about tax policy here in the United States, how we get food to people who need food, and here's how you join us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that. That address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we're going to be talking about the new book, and oh, it's so good. Pops is the name of it. A life of, actually, he liked to be have his name pronounced as Louis Armstrong. A life of Louis Armstrong. Terry Teachout will be joining us. The book looks at, well, much of the last century in terms of race issues and talent issues. He grew up in New Orleans, and the parts that deal with his early years in New Orleans are pretty extraordinary. So it's a great book. It's coming up after 10 today. And we welcome your phone calls now. David Beckman is our guest, president of Bread for the World. Our number is 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with Sarah from Oshkosh. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. My question or comment, both, is about, obviously, you're doing some wonderful work to really reach out and help people get fed and get relief. Where do we bring in, or how does one bring about teaching people to fish beyond just giving them a fish to get them through the next day?
Well, Sarah, I really appreciate your question. Bread for the World works mainly on helping people fish, teaching people how to fish. So when we're working in developing countries, our emphasis is not on the food that we're passing out in an emergency situation, but in how to transition from that to support for agriculture, health systems, a strong economy, so that, in fact, people are able to provide for themselves. It is absolutely the right thing to do in developing countries, also in our own countries. You know, nutrition assistance to kids this summer is important, but the more important thing is letting their parents go to work and trying to set up systems so that if they are working, that they get enough money to feed their kids from their own labor. So your point is right on. I agree.
Thanks, Sarah, for the call. We go next to Michael from Milwaukee. Hi, Michael.
Hello. How you doing this morning?
Fine, Michael. How are you?
Thank you for having me on the program.
Sure.
And I just want to give kudos to the guests for making reference to the fact that the president only mentioned poor people in the State of the Union address only one time. And it seems like I would just like to make the observation as if he can't talk about poor people with civil rights because he's black and he might show favoritism towards that. When really you look at the president's background, I think we should be more concerned about him showing favoritism to the elite or, you know, to the middle class. But I think the conversation about the poor people we have right here in America definitely needs more attention.
I agree with you too, Michael. The Democrats in general are a little bit wary of talking about poor people. I'm just struck right now that the president's budget is pretty good for poor people. Better than the State of the Union message. It's more explicitly good for poor people. And I think, what he does is more important than what he says. But also if you're not talking about what you're trying to do, if we're afraid to talk about poor people, probably we won't end up doing as much as if we're explicit about it. So I'm glad that the action looks good, but I'd like the rhetoric to be as strong as his action.
Thank you, Michael,
for the call. And what's that all about, do you think, David? Is that just political, this focus on middle class, because people in Congress and the president will figure they'll get more votes from the middle class? Or
yes.
It is. Yes.
Well, and
yes.
The other thing, I mean, there's what is the case is that a lot of poor people think of themselves as middle class. And many people, I think half the population, falls under the poverty line sometime. So, you know, it's poverty is not just something that happens to those people. Poverty is something that happens to many of us. A lot of people who are solidly middle class for part of their life have some event that happens. They suffer a divorce or a health care crisis or mental illness in the family. So then they, in fact, a lot of the people who are under the poverty line at a given time, who are really poor, think of themselves as middle class. So I think part of the rhetorical issue is if you talk about helping the poor, even those people think, oh, you're talking about somebody else. I need help.
But right.
So there's some logic, and it started with, I think, Bill Clinton, you know, a sense among the Democrats that they shouldn't talk about poor people. They should try to do some things for children, education, health care that would benefit middle class and poor people. And that's continued now with Obama, especially now that the situation for the Democrats has gotten tougher. I'm glad that he's doing things for poor people. I really am. But I also think our rhetoric needs to be clear that we do have a lot of people in this country who are just poor. And if we don't talk about them, chances are, in the end, we won't do much about it.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael, for your call. We go to Amy next from Madison. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Hi.
I understand that the guest used to work at the World Bank. And isn't it the case that the World Bank actually helped to contribute to poverty in Haiti by conditioning loans to Haiti on its changing its agricultural policies so that it would grow less of its own rice, for example, and have to import it from other countries like the United States?
It's a tough question from Madison. I love Madison, Wisconsin. Madison is one of the few places in the country where I always get questions from the left. I love Madison. I think you're right on this one. I mean, I think the World Bank in general is a pretty good institution, actually, and it is focused. The purpose is to reduce poverty, and I think they do a lot of good. I've also read that in the case of Haiti, that it was, I think, actually the International Monetary Fund that pushed Haiti to open its markets probably to, you know, it was a way of reducing economic inefficiencies. But one impact of that was that they lost their rice production, because rice production in the United States is heavily subsidized. Big rice farmers in this country get big checks from the U.S. Treasury. So all that subsidized rice flooded into Haiti. So you can go to Haiti, and on one side of the road is a big field that used to be a rice field that's now barren. And on the other side of the road is a little shack where they're selling rice produced in the USA. It's an example of how our agricultural subsidies, there are some payments to rural people that make a lot of sense, but the way our farm subsidies are structured, we give large amounts of money and protectionist subsidies to a lot of people who have a lot of money. And rice is a key example of that. And I think it did combine. You're right that the World Bank and the IMF pushed for free trade. The U.S. still had subsidies in place, and it did a lot of damage.
Thank you.
Thanks, Amy, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. David Beckman is our guest this hour, and he is president of Bread for the World, founder and president of the Alliance to End Hunger, and author of Transforming the Politics of Hunger and Grace at the Table, Ending Hunger in God's World. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Can we talk a little bit about how we change this and the figures that relate to the amount of money that people in the poor people in developing countries spend on food for a day. I understand that it's up to 80% of their income to buy food. I imagine that's not the same in the United States. Tell me if it is.
No.
How do you change that? That's a huge percentage of your income. Why so high?
Because they're poor. They don't have very much money, so you got to eat. And so many people in poor people in developing countries certainly spend two-thirds of everything they have on a couple plates of rice a day. And the way you change that is to double their income by helping them, as Sarah said, you know, by helping them be more, about half of them are the poorest people in the world are farmers. So if you can get a rural road out there so that they can buy some fertilizer, get some better seeds, a lot of them have crummy seeds. They don't have high productive seeds, so you get them better seeds, better fertilizer. And then the road also allows them to sell some of their product to the city or export some. So it's quite feasible in many of those situations for people to raise their incomes pretty quickly with existing technologies. And if their income goes from $1 a day to $2 a day, then they won't spend so much of it on food. You know, the proportion that they spend on food will go down. Now, actually, it's interesting for an agricultural state like Wisconsin. As really poor people escape from poverty, they do spend the bulk of their money on improving their on more food and then improving their diets. So a farm state like Wisconsin has a self-interest stake in reducing poverty in the world. When Asia in the 1990s was able to reduce poverty and hunger, agriculture in the Midwest of the U.S. did great because a lot, you know, they imported more food and also more quality, more diverse diets. Mm. So the same, if we can help people in Africa to escape from really dirt poverty, that's disproportionately a good market for agriculture in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And so the percentage that poor people in this country pay for their food would be what, David?
I'm not entirely sure. I would guess on average a third or something like
third.
That.
So it's significantly different.
The other thing that you raised is how to change this. And on all these issues, I think that the way to change it is fundamentally to change laws and structures, which means it starts in Wisconsin. Political power in the United States is not in Washington. Political power is in Oshkosh and Milwaukee and Madison. We have the political power. Our nation, our government is very important to in shaping our own society, opening up opportunities for people in our own country who can't get ahead, and also because we're the most powerful country in the world, we do things and that make a big difference to poor people around the world. Sometimes we don't even know. You know, these rice subsidies, the people who get those subsidies may not even know what damage they did in Haiti. So the way that a big part of getting the whole world and certainly our own country to make progress against hunger and poverty, the progress that's so clearly possible, is for people here in Wisconsin and across our nation to engage in these issues, to think about these issues, and then to contact their representatives and senators to speak up to and then to vote on these issues, to let them know that if they do the right things for hungry and poor people, that we're more likely to vote for them. What I see is that, in fact, our democracy works remarkably well. And so what Bread for the World does is help people who care about these issues connect with some specific things that are happening in Washington and contact Senator Feingold, contact Senator Cole, contact their own representative, and let them know that reducing poverty in a specific way on this issue, reducing poverty, is important to me. And if you want my vote, this is specifically what I want you to do on this issue.
We go next to Kurt from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. Good to hear on the radio, Dave. I'm for many, many years, a member of Bread for the World.
Great.
And a financial supporter, also a former dairy farmer. I'm really concerned that the way you're laying out the farm program in this country and how it impacts on other farmers around the world with regard to poverty and so forth is leaving a lot unsaid.
Sure.
For instance, you know, the pricing in our quasi-free market farm commodities in this country is not controlled by farmers, but for instance by the traders, the huge elevators like Cargill, and so on and so forth. I'm sure you know about this. The one bushel of rice at a very low price from Haiti or Jamaica or wherever else, that one bushel will then set the price for millions of bushels at below the cost of production, and the so-called, what you call a subsidy to farmers, is actually to enable the farmers to continue producing at a cost below the at a price below the cost of production for the benefit of the bread makers, the grocers, the internet, the transnational traders, and so on and so forth. Now, admittedly, over the years, we do have millionaire farmers and multi-billion corporations that own or lease and are in the business of producing commodities, but the working farmers are not the recipients of some kind of welfare. That is to make up the difference between the cost of their production and delivering it to the market at a cheap price. And opening up all commodities to international trade without taking that into consideration would simply create a whole class of poverty-stricken, even more poverty-stricken farmers in this country, and would not raise that much the living standards for others.
Well, Kurt, thanks for calling. I really appreciate that you've been active in Bread for the World over the years. And the issue of farm policies and how they could be made better is pretty complicated. I think you did a good job of making the distinction between millionaire farmers, billionaire companies who are involved in commodity production, and working farmers. There are a lot of people. The rate of poverty is higher in rural America than in urban America. There are a lot of people in rural America, including a lot of farm families, who are really struggling. And so you're right that we've got to be, I should be careful not to give the impression that whatever help a farm family's getting, that's illegitimate. But I do think that we have, that there's scope for modifying our farm and rural policies so that money that now goes, a lot of money is going in $250,000 checks to landholders who live in Manhattan or in Miami Beach. So I just think there is scope, and those interests go to Congress and they talk as if they represented struggling farmers. I think there is scope for modifying our farm policies in ways that would make them better for struggling farm and rural families in Wisconsin, also more environmentally sensitive. And we could do that and at the same time open up opportunities for really poor farmers around the world. Because of the growth of population and the progress that some countries like China and India and even Africa are making against poverty, there's going to be a huge increasing demand for food over the next 20, 30 years. Mm. And I think we need an efficient, dynamic system that will help the United States agriculture and global agriculture expand to respond to those growing markets. It could be a time of real opportunity for farmers in America too. But I do think that there are real big reforms that could happen. And in my experience, it's partly because the millionaire farmers and the billionaire companies are well organized. It's hard to get Congress to see straight on this.
Thanks very much for the call. Can we talk about charity for a moment? It seems to me that we keep thinking we're going to have less need for people to stock food pantries, to make sure that people have enough to eat. But having dinners, et cetera, and that need just seems to be growing. How important is charity in taking care of short-term hunger, long-term hunger, and what about the burden that it places on churches, particularly, who are doing feeding programs for homeless shelters and all kinds of places?
Well, as a preacher, I'm really encouraged that at least the figures I've seen indicate that giving to religious congregations is up during the recession. And we've been looking at what churches across the country are doing in response to the recession. It looks to me like a lot of churches and other religious communities are doing new things to reach out in the middle of the recession. Charity is really tremendously important. One thing, it does meet people where they are. A lot of poor people, especially when they first fall into poverty, are just disorganized. They're desperate. And so to think that they're going to go into the food stamp office and apply for food stamps is just that they need help today in because the problems have just mounted. They can't make their rent. So charity, churches and charities can respond to poor people where they are and in a human way figure out what do they need to do because you can't – charity and government, they're not – government programs are not going to get you out of poverty. They can help you, but you got to get yourself out of poverty. So I think in a church setting or a charity setting, you can talk about what the individual or that family needs to do. You can meet their needs for the day. And then – but then if they're going to need income support for any length of time, no church can pay their rent.
Right.
You know, maybe 1 month, but then you're done. So if a family has a health crisis, somebody has to stay home from work in order to take care of an infirm person in the house or those kinds of things happen, then thank God we do have government programs of assistance. They are not that – you know, I think some people think that they're more generous than they are, but they are really important. For example, on food, all the – churches and charities in the country probably provide hungry people about $4 billion a year in groceries, which is a lot of groceries, but this is a very big country. The national programs, food stamps, WIC, school lunches, and school breakfast, provide about $50 billion a year in food. So they're, even in normal times, they're 10 times the size of what we do through charity. So it's important that if Congress decides to increase those programs by 10%, it's in effect it has the same effect of doubling all that we would
right.
do. Or the other way, if one day you know we've got a budget crisis, let's cut those programs by 10%. That in effect wipes out all that we do through churches and charities. So when I go to churches, 90% of the folks are helping out through soup kitchens and food banks. But maybe 1 in 100 has done anything to get our government to do better and to do more with the federal nutrition programs. And they are at least 10 times as important to poor people.
David Beckman is our guest. He is president of Bread for the World. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network. Second hour of our program this Thursday, we'll talk with the author of Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong. We go back to phone calls now. Bill from Viola. Oh, no, it's Eugene is next from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Hi. Kathleen. Your guest mentioned importing textiles from Haiti. The only difficulty with that, a lot of them, I think, were made in sweatshops. And at one time, Walt Disney's Enterprises was having their T-shirts made down there in sweatshops at 30 cents an hour. So the question is, when Haiti is rebuilt, will those sweatshops come roaring back?
Yeah, I think, in my thinking, this is a hard issue, but I think the important thing is that when we open up trade with a country, that they observe basic labor rights. They're going to pay less than we would find acceptable in this country. But in many situations, people are glad to have jobs, even though the wages wouldn't be U.S. wages. But basic labor rights means no child labor, no forced labor. and that people have a right to organize so that the workers themselves are able to have an influence on their conditions. And if they have a right to organize, I think, so that they are, have a say in whether they want to work in that place or not, I think that's key. It's, you know, moving forward in terms of free trade is only part of it. I think the other part of what we need to – in fact, if we open up trade opportunities for the Haitis of the world, that does also raise the real incomes of people in this country, because we get less expensive T-shirts or less expensive whatever it is. But I think the other part of a trade agenda is – providing health care for all Americans, better education for all Americans, good nutrition for all American children so that they grow up to be really smart, creative workers that can compete in the global economy. So it's not just a matter of reducing trade barriers. It's also investing in our own people so that our people aren't impoverished as people in Haiti or Mexico struggle out of poverty.
Thanks, Eugene. Here's an email that's come in, David. From Steve, can you ever realistically address poverty-induced hunger without simultaneously limiting the population in those areas?
These are all good questions, Steve. It is important to there are places where you have population, just runaway population growth. And what that means at the family level is a very poor mom and dad with 5-6 kids. Of course those kids are going to be poor. They're not able to take care of those kids and get them to school and pay their school fees and put them in uniforms to get them to school. So I do think that family planning is part of what needs to happen. That can be done in ways that are sensitive to the religious concerns of some people. And then it's a cycle. In fact, the most powerful way to reduce the population growth rate is to let the girls go to school. If girls know how to read and write and add and subtract, they will have fewer children. Mm-hmm. And it's also important that women have legal rights, that they can own land. There's lots of evidence that shows that reducing poverty and especially reducing the oppression of girls and women is the most powerful way to reduce population growth. So it's not that you just work on one side or the other. I think you got to do both.
We go next to Bill from Onalaska. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I have three quick comments. One is we have a sort of a soup kitchen here in La Crosse. I notice the same people are every day, and the same people are usually after lunch they all smoke a cigarette. You know, I wonder if they smoke a pack of cigarettes a day. That's kind of a common quantity of cigarettes people smoke. Well, that would be $7 a day. I mean, a guy could eat on $7 a day. Maybe you can comment on that. Number two, I have traveled a lot of the world, and I know, people in many places are very poor, living very, very basically. But when I compare how they live to how our poor live, I think our poor are rich. And I wonder how do I handle that in my little brain? I mean, I see people who, probably get along with less than our poor, who are, let's say lower middle class in some countries. I don't know how to handle that. Number three is child labor. I was in Africa. I went to a organization that was trying to promote the idea that many children want to work to help support their families, and they have to work to help support their families. What they were saying is, we don't want laws against us working or sweatshops, regulations so children can't work. We just want to be treated humanely. When we're sick, we want to go home. We want to have a few hours a day to play. We want to have some time to study. And I wonder what your comments are on any of those questions.
Go ahead, David.
You got tough questions. Let me take the cigarette one. One of my sons is recovering from addiction and alcoholism, and so he's because of that terrible mental illness, and he's been poor and is on the edge of poverty now. And a lot of people who have that, I've just been convinced that for at least many people, this is a genetic mental illness, which does, he's, my son, thank God, is in Alcoholics Anonymous and he's in recovery, and there, that's possible. You know, you can get out of this. At least you can deal with it. But a lot of people who are vulnerable to addiction, including my son, smoke. And I, you know, it's the one addiction he allows himself because alcohol and drugs would do so much more damage to him. I hope he stops that. But I just when I go to AA meetings with him, after the AA meeting, virtually everybody lights up. It's a terrible thing because my kid's going to die younger than he needs to die because of it. He is spending a lot of money on cigarettes. So you're right on that. On the other hand, I know from my own boy's experience, my own son's experience, that giving up those cigarettes, I think, is virtually impossible for him right now. So I agree with the point. At the same time, I'm glad you feed those people, even though they light up.
Thank you so much for the call. Anne from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I think the problems... Oh, there's an echo on the phone, but I'll be really quick. I think the problems in Haiti and in other poor countries are mostly political. For instance, a report from Haiti this week said that U.S. troops were refusing to take any orders from the United Nations workers there because, of course, we're a sovereign country. I think we're the only country in the world that treats the U.N. With such disdain. But second, first, in colonialization and U.S. imperialism, and the privatization demanded by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund creates huge amounts of debt that the poor countries of the South just can't, they can't manage them without impoverishing themselves further. And the South in the world mostly has great soil, or it started out with great soil, great climate, lots of resources. There's no reason for them to be poor. The northern countries have, you know, less good climate to horrible climate and not as good resources, but they have just mercilessly exploited the South. And as long as that continues and this globalization, privatization kick, so-called free trade continues, I don't think we're really going to solve these problems of poverty and hunger.
David.
Well, I agree with part of what you're saying. Clearly, in Haiti, a lot of the problem is centuries of exploitation. These people were all brought to be slaves on big plantations, and then when they declared independence and established an independent country, they, because it was a black country, it was an international pariah for more than a century. And in this century, the United States has repeatedly invaded or manipulated Haiti. So that exploitation is part of the reality, and I think you know, I think part of the solution is for us who live in a powerful country to do exactly what you're doing, try to wrap our minds around the issue and push our government to support the kinds of things that we think will help people struggle out of poverty and not do some of the things that we sometimes do that are a setback for people in poor countries.
We have about a minute and a half left. What are your big programs for this year? You mentioned tax policy as being one of those, David.
Right. Bread for the World is right now asking churches across the country this year to take up an offering this year. But it's not an offering of money. It's an offering of letters to Congress. We think that to reduce child hunger, we need to weigh in on the tax debate. There's going to be a huge tax debate in our country this year. And in fact, there are some tax provisions that are important to the working poor, working people. And we think that by defending and maybe strengthening those tax rules that help the working poor, that may be our best chance this year to help reduce hunger and poverty in our own country. So people who want to be part of that can go to Bread for the World's website, which is bread.org, Bread.org. Bread.org. Did you get that?
I get it.
and find out how they can ask your senators, your representatives to help us defend the tax provisions that help poor people. And also there are great resources there for churches or groups that might want to participate as a group in this nationwide offering of letters.
Okay. And the issues are – what's encouraging is that you see some progress here. Most people think it keeps getting worse and worse, but one of your messages is good has been done.
Right. I think God is moving in our time to overcome hunger and poverty. And I hope before I die that there's a lot less poverty in our country. And I think it's quite possible if we mobilize, if we push, we don't have to have millions of kids going hungry in the USA. And also around the world, we've made progress against hunger and poverty. I hope to see much more progress before I die.
Thank you, David. Thanks for being with us. David Beckman, president of Bread for the World. He is going to be speaking at the Interfaith Conference 40th Anniversary Luncheon taking place today in Milwaukee. He was also president of the World Bank. He's been at Bread for the World for 15 years, was president of the World Bank for 15 years as well. And he is the author of a number of books and articles. He is an economist and a clergyman. We thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning and also to Connor O'Brien for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up and we'll return and talk about POPs.